Hello and welcome to the Advanced Age Roleplay Gamers Podcast. I'm Nathan, I'm one of your hosts, and I've also got my co-host with me today. Say hi. What's your name again?
Hi, what's your name again? Sorry, Matt here. Nice to see you.
What a dick. Anyway, we are graciously presented with the presence of Jack Kellum of Gods and Game Masters. That's his website. Take a look at that. And Jack, if you could say the title of your website for me, because I like the way you say it dramatically.
Of Gods and Game Masters.
There we go. Yeah. That's the one.
That's the name of the website. That's the name of my YouTube, my TikTok, everything pretty much on social media. I changed all my handles to it. Because the only reason I'm on social media is for the, presence there. I'm not on social media for me as a person. I probably wouldn't deal with it at all.
Cannot blame you. It is a pit of despair. but yeah, so I've Gods and Game Masters is your publishing title also, and you publish yes. to Drive-Thru, and also, are you on Itch?
I am on Itch, but I've had almost no sales on Itch.
Okay.
Which I thought was interesting. I used to publicize all the places you could get it, and the only place anybody would ever buy was from Drive-Thru. My biggest sales were on DM's Guild, but I have now removed everything I had on DM's Guild completely because straw broke the camel's back. I can't support Wizards of the Coast even indirectly at this point.
Yeah, let's talk about, let's talk about like what kind of things you publish for players and GMs to use. What are the types of, I know you do, you're prolific. I've looked at your library and there's a lot. but what are the kind of the short view, what kinds of things are you publishing for people
okay,
to use
so,
in their games?
All the stuff that was on DM's Guild that I pulled down was mostly a series I called my alternate ecology series. And the articles that were the basis of them are all still available on my website. I started with an alternate ecology of dragons, explaining a different approach to how dragons interact with the world that explains a lot of their behavior, which we don't really see good explanations for in the more standard lore. For instance, and this is a little bit of a spoiler, but people should go look at my alternate ecology and my alternate ecology of dragons revised anyway, because basically the only dragons that actually hoard treasure are the mature females, the queens.
Okay.
And they have a group of males that are subordinate to them that go out and gather treasure for them the way some birds do and things like that. They bring presents to be considered as mates. But that's not really the super interesting part. I mean, it is interesting in that they're matriarchal and they have their treasure there. Some of their treasure is just because they need a lot of metal to keep up their scales. And these other things. So they actually eat the hoard. The thing is, the reason you'll find more gold and things in their hoards is because gold as a super heavy element doesn't get digested.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah.
They don't have droppings, or rather they do. It's just that it's part of their hoard because, you know, a gem that isn't flawed, gold, platinum, high atomic weight metals don't get digested. Magic items don't necessarily get digested, et cetera, et cetera.
So me as a 12-year-old just keep thinking, okay, you're raiding this this dungeon horde as a group of ne'er-do-well adventurers, and you're basically stealing dragon poop. So that as a 12-year-old, I can appreciate that aspect. That's pretty neat.
The other interesting part about it is I decided I would come up with what I thought was a logical explanation for the interaction between dragons, dragonborn, and kobolds. And here it is. A female dragon has a number of different mates and can choose which ones, like a badger, she can retain the sperm and choose which ones to use to fertilize her eggs. But when she produces a clutch, only she'll produce a large number of eggs, but only a couple of them maybe are going to be fertilized because she doesn't want to have, you know, to put a whole bunch more dragons out there and have a lot of competition, right? And for every female dragon, there'll be like four males in a clutch. The rest of the eggs are unfertilized. And like the unfertilized eggs of an ant, they create drones. Those drones are kobolds.
Huh. Okay.
And then just like an ant colony has both workers and soldiers, some of those drones are dragonborn.
Okay.
So dragonborn is literal.
Okay. So you obviously put a lot of thought into like why these fantasy creatures that we kind of just take for granted sometimes and how they and just making them make sense.
Yeah, and coming up with an approach to them that is different than the standard so that people have another way to use them in their world. More than anything, I'm a world builder. Even when I'm dealing with supplements for somebody else's world, right? So I have world building ideas in everything I do. I can't get around it. But like the first one was dragons. I've done werewolves. I've done Illithid. I had my illicit Illithiad. I had Aboleth, beholders. Those are all three tied together in their background. And I've got an alternate cosmology of the far realm wrapped into that as well. Now, unfortunately, all of those are no longer available. But that was what a lot of my stuff was this alternate ecology series. I also did a Domain of Dread for Ravenloft that was druidic. I did a couple of big bad evil guys, a new version of Strahd that takes into account his the very first thing you hear about him. I was the warrior good and just. Where on his stat block do you see warrior skills?
Yeah, okay.
So also, he's kind of weak by the stat block. So my version of him has 6 levels of Oathbreaker Paladin.
Hmm. Okay.
Because that, to me, is what he was before he became a wizard.
So I also
did a version of CR30 version of Lolth, which got pretty popular.
So where do you find most of your... I guess the folks that find the most value in your world building tools, how do they find you? How do they come across your material mostly?
That's a hard part, of course, because getting promotional material out there is a bear, and I have to try to get people's attention through social media of various kinds. I do a world building prompt of the day every day and it's on almost every day. It's on Twitter, Blue Sky, Mastodon, Threads, and then I have a world building prompt of the day video that goes on to TikTok, Insta, and YouTube.
Yeah, the shorts.
And hopefully that gets people knowing, hey, this guy has some idea what he's doing with world building. And then you can go look at my website and see that stuff. You can see my longer form world building videos on Of Gods and Game Masters YouTube. And you know, hopefully that gets people to see what I have. Like I don't get, in terms of my actual written content, I don't get a lot of sales. So maybe, you know, once I can get my brand a little bigger, that'll work out differently. So, I'm transitioning more of my work to drive-through.
Right
now I only have some stuff for the successor states of Rega, which is a 5e setting I built myself. And the interesting there is the tie-in is in my world building videos, that's the setting that I was literally building as an example in the world building video, which was kind of intended as an easy mode. Like the first episode is called Gods Filing Off the Serial Number. The basic idea is you just find a bunch of gods that you think are really cool from whatever pantheons, throw them all together, change the names to a single naming convention, and then mix and match and modify them and see what you come up with.
Yeah. So what's, so in that, is it, are there like step-by-step guides of, or and examples and, you know, what kind of tools are in there to, for, besides what you just kind of mentioned, for people to build their own pantheons? Is there, do you have, is it like,
yeah, the, detailed the, guide of the gods filing off the serial numbers is the, like I said, kind of the easy mode version. And it explains how to take the concepts of various gods and scratch off the names so you're not offending anybody particular who might have that as part of their belief system, but get the core of that god and how to use, you know, pick gods to cover all of the, say, if it's for D&D, the various domains that you need covered and the various alignments that you need covered. And it is kind of a, that first video is kind of a step-by-step. And then my next video is about creating the creation myth. More recently, I put up a short, deeper dive on how to create a pantheon that is directly inspired by a real world pantheon, but is not that real world pantheon.
Okay,
and that's on my website. I don't have a video for that one yet.
Now, Matt, I have lots of questions, but feel free if you have something that's kind of itching, burning.
I guess I was gonna. Nathan, great. Nathan jumped right in. He's like, "What are you doing?" So I guess I'm thinking more of like just telling folks who don't know you just a little bit about yourself. I know we've kind of jumped right in. Like I said, Nathan's all about the get to the heart of it. I just let people know about you and sort of like how you got into TTRPGs. You know, maybe as a start, and then I've got a series of softballs after that.
So I have kind of a spiel that is in my linked, it's in my pinned post on Twitter. I'm Jack Kellum. My company is Of Gods and Game Masters. I'm Jack the Giant Killer, Jack Gogsbane, all these other fancy titles, right? Master of Myths, Sian Chai of Stories. I build worlds, pantheons, gods, monsters. I drink coffee, and I know things. Basically, almost everything that I work with is somewhere in, not everything, but a lot of what I work with is the conjunction of mythology and folklore with tabletop role-playing. A lot of the things I make are inspired by mythology. Like one of the things I have on drive-thru right now is a book called The Fomor Folio, which is 49 fiendish fae stat blocks for 5e for a unified group of monsters based on the idea of what if all of the Unseelie fae concepts were basically part of the original Fomor host from Irish mythology. And then I also put in a stat block for the original Green Knight from the Gawain and the Green Knight stories as a sort of beneficial archfey. But it's that conjunction of ancient stories with the modern storytelling methods, right? It's the drawing on that deep, deep well of mythology and folklore and bringing that more directly into modern role-playing instead of this sort of half-understanding that we got from the Gygaxian era. Don't get me wrong, started a great thing, very grateful for it, but their understanding of mythology was, shall we say, lacking. What I do primarily is I do make some content still, and I'm going to keep making that content. Right now I do a lot of professional game mastering because that actually pays me. Whereas, you know, until I get bigger and get enough attention, it's hard to make any sort of real money selling materials. When it comes to how I got into gaming, well, let's go back to 1981 in a KB toy store in Louisiana, where I'm walking by a display and I say to my dad, "Hey dad, look at that." And that is the Moldvay basic set for Dungeons and Dragons with the sorceress on the cover with the dragon coming out of the water. Okay. And I said, "Hey dad, we could use that to play Tolkien as a family." Cause I had read, you know, I'm 8 years old, but I had read, The Hobbit by the time I was 5 or 6 and read The Lord of the Rings by the time I was 7. I had already gotten through the Silmarillion at 8. So picked up the game and, I couldn't actually convince my dad to be dungeon master. So I did it. And I've been a dungeon master and game master ever since. And it would be quicker to list the game systems I have not had any experience with than the ones I have. I've got a partial list on the front of my website.
Yeah, you can see.
I was looking at that list. So that's a pretty extensive list.
Something I've been, I've been obsessed with role playing ever since I encountered it, because it really is a modern expression of humanity's most ancient way of entertaining themselves, which is communal storytelling. So yeah, I've been doing that for 42-ish, 43. The years blur. Long time, yeah, anyway.
Long time.
Yeah. But I only got into it professionally, actually trying to make money staying in the space after I hurt my back at work. Mm. I've been doing hard physical labor for most of my life. I was driving forklifts, and I became partially disabled because of a few compressed and extruded discs in my back. I could not drive a forklift anymore, obviously. And I went, you know what? I'm actually going to give this a try. And this thing that I spend all this time and effort on, I'm going to see if I can make it a career. So
it's tough. It's tough. It's a lot of, it's tough putting yourself out there. So, so congratulations on really taking it on. It's not something, for the meek. You really have to.
It's an interesting thing, the topic of like the paid GMs and stuff. And so that's what I want to know. So I have, I've not done it. I have a lot of angst when I run, like just for my friends.
Oh yeah.
Like people just coming over to my house and I'm going to run a session. I get like an extreme, like almost panic attack because it's under good intention. I want my friends to, they're spending their time, they're driving, all the way. I hope they have a good time. It's like that pre-stage anxiety. And so the idea of like pay GMing, I was like, oh my gosh, but I've done it. I was traveling in New York City, and I was there for the weekend with the family, and they were just doing stuff I was totally not interested in. And I just looked up this place, found this place. They had a thing, and I went, and I had a great time. Like they have a program, they hire people to be GMs at the store, and they run and they get to train. So I had a really great time. I was nervous about playing with strangers, but I had a great time. And so later during the pandemic, we found there's a service out there for kids called Outschooled. And it's usually just for like school, like stuff. It's a lot for like people who do homeschooling, but they were offering D&D as well. And they were people teaching, and it was all for little kids, right? So we've done it. We've had positive experiences. And so it's just how, when you got started, how did you feel when you're getting started? How do you feel now? And like, what are some of the challenges and rewards you get for, working in this line of business?
So when I first went into, I had actually by this point already run, before I tried to pro GM and run paid games, I had actually already run a few short actual plays. You can find them on my website. They didn't last. You can find them on my YouTube. They didn't last very long. The first couple of ones I did were for charity through Tales from the Table Studios. And that's where I do my actual plays even now. We've got another one coming out eventually that I can't talk about because it's still hush hush until we're done recording it. But, I did one in my successor, States of Rega, for the charity, and that got extended a little longer, and we did a couple of seasons, but it didn't. It kind of fizzled out because of people's commitments, right?
Yeah.
I have a short GURPS actual play that I did for that same charity, because that allowed us to get Steve Jackson Games to give us some GURPS stuff to hand out as rewards for the charity.
Okay, great.
GURPS is one of my favorite games just because of its flexibility. But that was a Western horror game. So I was already used to a certain extent, one, running public facing, right? Two, running for people at a table that I did not necessarily know them all very well. But still, when I first put up my actual first professional game mastering thing, I was lucky because the first person to ask me was someone I already knew, who was familiar with my work because they were in a LARP that I helped run, which was interesting because it was a superhero LARP. You don't hear a lot of those.
Oh, yeah.
But I had run a Mutants and Mastermind, helped to run a Mutants and Mastermind superhero LARP, and this person came to me and commissioned me to run superheroes for them. And I do that every Sunday now. That was the first game I picked up. So I knew at least some of the people, right? Now, don't get me wrong, I was nervous going in, but that pretty quickly got, pretty quickly wasn't a big deal for me because I had had some stage experience. I had experience dealing with people, you know, again, in a public facing way. And several of my other games have come from players in that game either recommending me to people or getting me into other games. And now I have 5 games a week and I'm looking to maybe add more.
Oh, wow.
Bonuses, some really unexpected bonuses. First of all, I have gotten lucky, and it may not just be luck. When you get players who are paying for a game, they take it more seriously. Don't get me wrong, I love the feeling of playing with friends and in person more than anything. But you know how much time you spend just joshing around, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And the poking, and sometimes you'll have whole sessions where you don't get anything done because everybody's right. Just having fun. And that's
guaranteed
fun
10% content. For, right?
But if you really want a game that is focused on the game experience, the paid game does it because the people who are paying you to be there are focused on the experience, or so it seems to me thus far.
Yeah, I had read that in some of these articles that folks, you get a better for paid game, right? You get better consistency also.
Yes.
Right? And it's not, people have things happen. Life's busy, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But
not quite as, I would say, as whimsical, flaky. We in fact, our game group was called the once a month or whatever, because we just, it was always hit or miss. So I've heard that, you know, once people are paying, you know, they're, like you said, they're going to be more inclined to be regular. They're paying for experience. They want to have it. They're going to show up. And so, yeah, no, I've heard that's a definite advantage for this.
And I'm running, you know, 5 games a week, and I still haven't had, I was worried when I first went into it about horror stories of bad players that I would have to kick out, or mistreat people, or that would not take my safety tools seriously. But because, like, going through Start Playing, one, you have to have the safety tools. Two, you have your content warnings up. You have your safety tools already expressed at the beginning. Those people don't sign up for your games.
Yeah.
They go for somebody who has all these crazy content warnings and isn't running that kind of a game. Right.
Yeah.
So you actually get a better fit that way.
You mentioned Start Play. So where can people find you to hire your
assistant?
So I've heard,
for the majority of my professional game mastering, like a couple of them the Sunday game I got without Start Playing because that was prior connections.
Yeah.
I run a monthly game for my patrons because I do have Patreon, again, of Gods and Game Masters. My patrons at the $20 a month level get a free game every month. Right now, that's one small group of people who are in one game.
Yeah.
But mostly I run through Start Playing. I have on Mondays, I have a Wheel of Time game because they specifically asked for, you know, the Wheel of Time setting. And I happen to have the old 3.0/3.5 D20 Wheel of Time system. Tuesdays, I'm running the One Ring second edition in an alternate universe where Bilbo didn't go with the dwarves. So everything went wrong. And if you want the specifics of how that turns out, it's called The Last Hope, and that how the AU developed is in an article on my website.
Okay. Yeah, I've definitely going to check that out later. But I can see how you got that, because you read those books at such an early age. They're probably just ingrained in your brain. And you probably,
oh, yeah. For like the first 20, 22 years of my life, I reread The Lord of the Rings every year.
Mm.
So, yeah. And then Wednesday, the first game that I got on Start Playing that I got any attention for was, of course, Curse of Strahd. Because people want to, until you get a big rep yourself, people are looking for a thing they recognize.
Mm-hmm.
And Curse of Strahd is like one of the most popular modules out there. And I said, hey guys, I'm running a darker, more gothic Curse of Strahd. I've taken out the generic D&Disms and replaced them with things from the gothic horror trope. And this is a 1st through 20th campaign, not a 1st through 10th.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Because my Strahd is much more dangerous and I've got a lot more content added. My Wednesday group has almost left the original module. Like, there's only a couple things left from the original module for them to do before they get into just my own original content. One Thursday, I'm recording an AP, but the other Thursday, I'm now running Vampire the Masquerade 5th edition in a setting of my own. Barrow, Massachusetts. It's a fictional town that you can kind of think of as a cross between Gotham City and Ravenloft.
So, quick aside here, Matt and I both played a ton of Old World of Darkness, Vampire the Masquerade. Mm-hmm. I picked up 5th edition, but I haven't really spent much time going through with it. What would you say are the biggest differences from the Old World of Darkness to 5th edition?
So many less rolls. One of the biggest differences is the system is a heck of a lot smoother. There's no such thing as initiative. Everybody says, hey, I'm going to do this. And then you determine who's opposed to who, and then you roll dice. Die pools are smaller. It's far more narrative than it was. Like, in original VTM, which I played from the very beginning, I got it when it was still line rampant. Okay. You had your attack roll. They had their defense roll. Mm-hmm. You had your damage roll. They had their soak roll.
Yeah.
And all of these dice could be 15 or 20 dice. Come on. Yeah. It took forever.
Yeah.
They've greatly simplified that. It's a half and half success on the dice. So 1 through 5 is a fail. 6 through 10 is a success. And the thresholds are set very carefully. And you know, if I'm trying to attack you and you're trying to attack me, then we're doing an opposed roll. And if we both get the exact same amount, we both take damage.
Okay.
Otherwise, it goes to the win. So it's a very fast, very narrative game. And the addition of the hunger die mechanic, or the rage die mechanic that they have in Werewolf, is really cool. Because basically you have a hunger or rage stat that goes from 1 to 5. It doesn't add to your die pool. What it does is, however much of that you have, and normally the default is about 2, unless you're getting, you know, unless you've gotten hungrier or gotten more angry.
Mm-hmm.
That's how many of your normal dice you put aside and replace with rage dice or with hunger dice. And the results on the hunger dice can be different. Like if you roll a critical success, but it was mainly because of the hunger dice, you get what's called a messy critical. You achieved what you wanted, but you did it in the way the beast wanted, not the way you did.
Mm.
Oh, I'm going to kill this guy, but I'm just going to, you know, or I'm going to hit this guy and I'm just going to knock him unconscious. Well, you got a messy critical. So you punched his head off and then drank the blood from the stump, you know, for a much more direct mechanical effect of the beast affecting your every action. Right. And the really interesting thing about it is that both hunger and rage dice make you more likely to succeed if what you're doing is violent.
I like it. Well, thank you. That was, cool. I got a lot more than I expected out of that question. So that's pretty cool.
Also big deal. They've revised a lot of the lore to be less directly offensive.
Yeah,
which it needed badly. They're still confused about set, but, you know, that's fine. It all goes back to Robert E. Howard misunderstanding what the English archaeologists already misunderstood about the god Set in Egyptian mythology, because Set does not and never has had anything to do with snakes.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah,
Apophis is the snake god, and Set spends about half his time on the bark of Ra, the bark of the sun, defending Ra from the snake that's trying to eat the sun. Set is not a god of evil. He got turned into a god of evil sort of after the rise of the Osirian cult. But to begin with, he was a god of chaos that still defended the world from chaos.
Hmm. Interesting. And that's the nice thing about these games is, like, once you, there's this stuff that's written on the page, but once it's in your hands, you're now the author. That's kind of how I look at it. It's like, you could take the worst game in the world, and once you have it, you could just rework it the way you want, because things change over time, and understandings change, and 50 years from now, people are gonna look back at the stuff that we're doing. I can't believe they did that. That's horrible, and they'd probably be right. So it's good that, These things aren't written in stone. They're ours once you consume them yourself.
Absolutely.
That's beautiful. And I kind of interrupted you. That was your Thursday, and then you have Friday. You have a game usually.
Friday normally is my second Curse of Strahd game. So I've got two different groups going through the same module, and they've taken very different routes as to each thing they're going to do. Right, because Curse of Strahd, up to a point, is actually a sandbox.
Mm-hmm.
And they've gone in very different directions and handled certain situations very differently. Although I do find it interesting, they both handled their first nest of vampire spawn the same way, by showing up during the day and burning the building down.
As you do, yeah.
I mean, it was the smart thing to do. You go into a house full of vampire spawn when you're second level, you're probably not coming out.
Yeah, right. it's the D&D equivalent of nuke it from orbit, just to be sure, right? Fireball it from the street.
Absolutely. Yeah, I want to play Alien at some point. It sounds like a lot of fun.
It's awesome.
I've heard interesting things about the stress or horror mechanics.
So it's interesting, you were talking about the dice mechanic of the hunger and the sort of the rage. And I was thinking in the back of my head, this is similar, not the same, but very similar to the stress mechanic that is used in Alien. Those are, they get added to your dice pool, right? But it is that similar, you have the greater chance for success, but you have the greater chance for failure, right?
Inducing panic. So
And so that mechanic, what we've told people, and we'll just repeat it, is like, one of the cool things is, like, most adventure games, you get better and better and better. In Alien, the best your character is the moment you start. It's all downhill from there. Right. And it's kind of a cool sort of descent into it would be an interesting mechanic to use in, like, a Cthulhu system, which I've never played. So maybe they already have those, but it is kind of a cool addition to the gameplay.
I think I played Call of Cthulhu once or twice, but I also played Chill way back when.
I'm looking at it on my shelf over there. I haven't played it in like 25 years, but
of people don't realize that Chill creature feature, for instance, came out before anything White Wolf did, and allowed you to play monsters. You play werewolves, vampires, mummies.
Yeah, I don't think I have that. I have a few books, but I don't think I have that one.
Yeah, Chill creature feature was a lot of fun. And there's another book that actually came out just the year before Vampire, called Nightlife, which allowed you to play a variety of supernatural creatures, and they referred to themselves as the kin. And Vampire got Carpenter. Big, but they were not the first.
Yeah,
I don't really remember, Nathan, did Beyond the Supernatural and Night Spawn / Night Bane, sorry, from Todd McFarlane. Yeah, I don't know if those came out before Vampire or not. We had done, that was sort of our early entry into horror, was both Palladium's
Beyond the Supernatural. There were horror games obviously before Vampire. Beyond the Supernatural, you're not, at least mostly, not playing the monsters.
Not playing one. But I think then originally Nightspawn. I have the old Nightspawn cover, then they got sued.
And then it became Nightbane
allowed you to play sort of fantastic.
That was the CJ Corella. I also have CJ Corella's Witchcraft, which is his own system that he built for similar games. So that's really interesting because it's a single die 10. It's super simple, but I don't like the.
Yeah. So I was going to ask you when you're designing. So do you design campaigns to go with your worlds or set in other worlds? Is that something that you get involved with or adventures?
I absolutely do. I was in the process of building an ongoing campaign setting and campaign for the Dungeon Masters Guild.
Right. Yeah.
I had a 6th level adventure called Sunken Temple of the Swamp God that was available on DMG. I'm going to have to revise it to remove every reference to Wizards of the Coast product identity.
Yeah.
But I'm going to put it back out because I'm eventually going to get back to the setting supplement for it, which is called Marsh Cliff, which is a town on a cliff overlooking a swamp and all the things that are going on in this black swamp. And that's intended to be 1st through 20th, but each one is going to be set up as a one-shot, so you can play it as a campaign or toss them in as one-shots into any game you want.
So when you're, that kind of leads to my next question, so when you're running or creating adventures, do you prefer the sandboxy type, or do you prefer a more kind of linear tree type decision path?
That depends on the players. If I am creating something for publication, then it's going to be like there's going to be a through line, but how you get there, I try to put a number of different options in as to how to get there, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's almost impossible to run a module with a story without having a through line, without having, you know, guard at rails. Least some rails. Yeah. If you're building a sandbox, then that is more of a, you're building a hex crawl or whatever campaign, not a module, right? You don't really get a singular adventure out of that. You get, okay, well, here's the world and all the stuff in it, and you go find out what you've got. And for me, that's really just an extension of world building. And if you want sandbox, then you're not looking for, if you want sandbox, you have your story comes from how they engage with the world rather than here's the story. There may be a BBEG, but, you know, it's there much harder several. To structure that ahead of time. So what you do is you just build the world as fully as you can so that you're prepared for the proper levels of improv. That's one of the things I always want to tell people. When you're starting out, I definitely agree, start out simple, right? Start with one town, start with one threat, whatever. But no world building is ever wasted. The more deep and wide you build the world, the better you understand your world, the easier you can go, oh, well, they went this way. I already know what's over there. This happened. I already know who saw that and how they'll react. The deeper and the... Even if there's stuff you build that your player characters may never interact with, that feeling of gravity, that feeling of reality behind it, because you have more of the details worked out, will be felt at the table because you have an answer to their questions whenever they ask them. It will start to feel like a lived-in place, and that really helps with immersion. Now, again, you don't have to do that. By any means. And certainly when you're starting out, I've told people, like my GM tips on my website for session one is, first of all, don't stress out. Second of all, keep it simple. You need a town for a social hub. It almost certainly has a tavern. Every town does. That's your social hub. Things start in a tavern for a reason. It really was the center of the medieval community. And even if you're in science fiction, how many stories do we know of started in a cantina or revolved around quarks on Deep Space Nine? Because that social hub can be a space station like Babylon 5 or Deep Space Nine. It's still the same mechanic. What you need is that small social hub, whether it be a space station or a village or whatever, that is to a certain extent remote from the rest of the thing, so you don't have to worry about them yet, and nearby adventure. Hmm. preferably a nearby adventure that will affect the social hub if you don't interact with it.
Yeah.
So it gives you some more motivation than just, I want some gold. Don't get me wrong. There's nothing wrong with that motivation.
That's a pretty good motivation.
It is, but it pales after a certain point. And it can pale pretty quickly for some players. Like, some players just want to play the hero.
Mm-hmm.
And I want some gold is hard to make sense of if there's not a whole lot of things out there that they need the gold for, which can be a problem in D&D 5e, especially.
Yeah, they got to be hungry a little bit. And Matt probably knows where this is going. I make a point to occasionally make sure that the players are hungry.
Take all our stuff.
Yeah, I take all their stuff, and sometimes they end up naked. Not for any reason. It's not like a kink or...
don't miss a session.
Yeah, no. It can be really important what motivation they have for adventuring, whatever that is critical. When you sit down in your session zero, you talk about what kind of game you want to run, whether it's, well, we're big name heroes, or we're kids from the small town and we just want to make a name for ourselves. Whatever it is, your motivation for adventure shapes everything else. And of course, if you look at the hero's journey, then you've got the potential for that reluctant hero, that person who didn't want to be a hero, but now they're forced into it, which is why I like having a nearby source of adventure that they can't run away from, that is going to affect them if they don't do something about it.
Yeah.
Because even if they, after that, decide, hey, I'm good at this, let me go make some money doing it, or, hey, I'm good at this, let me continue to be a hero, the inciting incident was something they couldn't avoid.
So
you never get the question of, why am I doing this? Why should I care? Of course, I tend to feel that the players who go, why am I doing this? Why should I care? I'm like, because we sat down at the table to play a game about having adventures?
Sometimes that's not enough, you know?
Right. So I like to give a good hook and give good explanations of why your character will care. But I also think it's at least partially, obviously, on the player to have a character who has a reason to adventure. They may not want to, and that's fine. Not wanting to adventure is fine. Have a reason why they do it anyway.
Yeah, and that can be more fun, too. How many movies have we seen that where someone kind of gets dragged in through, like, mistaken identity or some other extenuating circumstances?
Grand majority of them, because, again, that's Joseph Campbell's hero's journey. It's not the monomyth he claimed it was, but it is a very, very common story archetype, right? You've got the person who's living their life as a normal person. The call to adventure comes. They refuse it. Then it comes again and they can't refuse it.
So let's take a little bit of time and talk about the types of content that you're planning on making going forward. Now that you've kind of pulled some stuff from the DM's Guild, what are you thinking about now? Since this is how you're want to make your income, there's what's your plan for making content generation something that actually puts money in your pocket.
All right. So for the moment, I'm focusing a lot on my paid GMing because that is a steady income that allows me to do these other things. I take commissions for world building I build, I build gods, villains, monsters. Anybody who needs those can come to me for them if they don't want to build them themselves or if they want something really interesting and vital. Right. I'm also currently involved in writing commissioned work for a company on Thread. I think you've probably seen them on Threads for the World of Drinterra. Hang on one quick second.
So yeah, you can edit this out. So.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah. It's something that we're working on. Shoestone Publishing. They are on Threads, and I'm writing content for them. They contacted me originally to do an article on why necromancy is seen as evil in their world specifically, because they saw my "Why is necromancy evil?" blog post.
Okay.
in which I explained why people see necromancy as so much more evil than the other magic types, right? Because there's more to it than just dead bodies with nothing else associated with them shuffling around. Necromancy is far more complicated than that, and socio-politically and religiously why it's so much more complicated and why people see it as such an evil act.
Yeah. I saw them referred to as late healer.
Sure. And if you and if you take it from just purely a game standpoint, right, why is raising a dead body particularly bad, right? And it isn't necessarily. If you're using, say, in D&D 5e, if you're using animate objects, then you're just manipulating a corpse. But animate dead in 5e especially specifically says if those creatures are left uncontrolled, they kill everything near them, which implies that they have an inherent evil or hunger to them, necrotic energy, et cetera, et cetera. It's a long article if you, you can go look at it. But I got hired to do that. I got I'm writing some gods and things for them. So I'm making some money on commissioned writing. But for my own content in future, I want to continue to flesh out my successor States of Rhaega, World of Telus, which you can find out about a lot. Just go to my website. We've got the successor States of Rhaega. You can watch how I developed it on my YouTube. You know, and in the articles in my world building section, because I have the article transcripts for the videos on the website. If people don't like to watch videos, you can just read the transcripts and it tells you how I developed a lot of it. But I also have, as supplements on DriveThru, I have the Gods of Rhaega, which is 21, a full pantheon of 21 gods. I have a custom format I built for gods because everybody else's books didn't have all the things I thought should be included, like the commandments that God gives, the rituals they perform, all the holy days, all those sorts of things. Ways to really have them feel like something that exists in your world rather than just, oh, I have this power. And then I have my Beastkin Vampire supplement, which also is available not just for 5e, but for Cypher system, which is what if some animals that were misused by humans and killed came back for revenge? And then I have my Spells of Eloquence, which is a few bardic spells and a bardic subclass called the College of Rhetoric. They're an intelligence-based, logic-based bard class.
Mm-hmm.
Because Successor States of Rhaega is sort of post-Greco-Roman, at least in inspiration, although it's quite different because they were an empire that lasted about, the empire lasted about 3,000 years, and they were very cosmopolitan. So the Rhaegan, there is a distinct Rhaegan ethnicity now, but it's a mixture of everybody who might have been around that Middle Sea. So they're generally a middle brown color.
So you're making me think of some other stuff. So you have, you have something else?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I want to continue to expand that universe, but I also have another series I'm working on called the Aberrant Apocrypha. The first one in that is called the Canon of the Void, and there are four other canons that are going with it. Canon of the Void is a complete cult and eldritch entity for 5e. The Faceless One, and he's called the Fundament of the Void. They're from outside time and space, of course. And they predate everything and post-date everything, etc. The other four are going to be wind, dust, water, and flame. And together they form the Pentagrammaton. So that's a series I'm going to be putting out. I want to expand the implied setting for my full morfolio as well, because it's a pseudo-Arthurian but purely Celtic setting where their round table equivalent is, they're called the Knights of the Broken Wheel because Their round table equivalent is a gigantic wheel from the chariot of the god Tyrannus that fell off while he was fighting evil gods.
But, so these all like sound like very, very detailed and well thought out, but it, I guess like when we're creating like our stuff, the actual play and stuff like that, like the hardest part I think is finding or allowing our audience to find us, because mm-hmm. there's people that will like what we do, and there's people that that won't like what we do, and like nobody really owes us an audience, but there are people out there that have found us. Go, oh, you guys are great, yada yada yada. But mm-hmm. you know, we could be the best, whatever, out there, but if people can't find us or don't just click on, you know, a video to listen, watch what we do, they're not going to know what we're doing. So like you as a content creator, creating these worlds, creating these settings, creating these deities, how do you get people interested just to even like go to drive through and open up the preview and start reading? Like, how do you, have you figured that out yet?
I haven't. No. I post, like, if I had ad money, right? Yeah. Then perhaps I could use ad money. As it is, when I come out with something new, or like once a week at this point, because I got tired of posting it every freaking day and having people get mad, I'll post a link to one of my supplements and go, hey, you know, this thing's out there. It's really hard, really hard to get eyes on your work. And that is one of the reasons I've been focusing on the two prongs of my new strategy, which is expand my footprint first.
Mm-hmm.
As I regularly put out YouTube material, as I regularly put out TikTok material, I then garner these people who are already looking at me, right? They're already paying attention. I thought I had managed that on Twitter to a certain extent. You know, I'm at almost 3,200 followers on Twitter, and it still isn't really dropping despite all the things that go on over there. But that doesn't translate to sales.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it doesn't. No.
You know, I've got 900 followers on Mastodon. I've got 650 or so on Threads, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. None of that translates to sales because the percentages are so low, right? I'd have to be in the tens of thousands or more to really start getting sales from that.
Well, you know, and actually I'm going to push back against that a little bit.
Okay.
So I'm in a technical sales job and have been for a really long time. And the biggest thing is value. So again, the product I sell, you know, it could be the best thing in the world, but only for the people that find what we're doing that has a valuable for their specific problem or need. So. I guess like your value from what just this hour of talking to you is these greatly detailed worlds and things that populate these worlds that make them feel lived in. And the, I guess the goal is finding the people that need that stuff. So there's people that are totally fine with just running a published module and just using what's the stat blocks that are in there. Like, those aren't your customers. You're looking for people that want something more detailed in campaigns that, like, this is not short campaign stuff. The kind of stuff you're doing, you're making stuff that would be in campaigns that would take years to complete.
Like,
so
both the Canon of the Void and the Filmortfolio, for instance, sure, they are collections of stat blocks that you could use to throw in your game wherever.
Right.
But they're also specifically set up, I like to call it beginner to BBEG. Like, the lowest CR is 1/2 and the highest in both of them is 30.
Right.
So you could run an entire game with only those monsters.
Mm-hmm. So there's other strategies that I think of too is so there's a lot of, and it really involves collaboration. Like you're doing a lot of stuff on your own. And you've done some collaborations. I saw you did that stuff with like Talking XP, and you've got this collaboration writing for this other. I think that is will give you more. To me, this is me just talking bullshitting. But to me, I think that's kind of where the food is writing stuff for other people that you know need stuff.
Right.
So finding, like you found that one guy you're writing for right now, one person writing for now. I think that, you know, and people doing Kickstarters, people who need like stretch goals for Kickstarters, right. That kind of stuff, I think could pay off like bigger dividends and long term, you know, collaboration. And say, hey, Jack's a great guy to work with. He did all this cool stuff for me that I couldn't have, would take me, you know, a year to do on my own. I think that kind of stuff is really, to me, that's what sounds like your strong suit is all that. The stuff you're doing is super labor intensive. Yeah. So that's my take. What do you think about that kind of stuff?
I think you're probably right, but that still comes down to getting my face out there and having people know that I'm available, right?
Yeah.
Because I have been specifically available for commissions and for hire for writing. I got into an art trade with Lost Haven Art on both Twitter and Threads. Mm-hmm. I provided some writing for his card-based Diablo-esque dark role-playing game Abaddon. Mm-hmm. And he's doing some drawing for me for some of my supplements.
Oh, that's great. So, there's other things too. Like there's other stuff outside of, you said you've written some stuff for Cypher. Are there other systems that you're looking at? Because there's a lot of noise in 5e.
There is. I'm definitely, I got involved in 5e specifically because at the time it looked like that's where the money was.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's be honest.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Of course.
It's not a bad system, but it's not my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
I was creating stuff for Pathfinder 1e for a while.
Yeah.
But there's not a lot of market for it because most of the Pathfinder 1e people went to 2e, and I don't like 2e.
Mm.
I realize that it's weird, but 2e for me is a weird place between too granular but still stuck in the class-based system.
Mm.
If I'm going to get granular and if I'm going to get customized, I'm going to go to a point by and make what I want instead of trying to figure out how to kludge it from 15 different things. I would love to design for GURPS. GURPS mm-hmm. is pretty much one of my favorites ever. I do design stuff for GURPS, but I do it for free because unless you're working for Steve Jackson Games, you cannot make GURPS stuff.
Yeah.
They don't have an open license sort of.
Right.
Interesting. Well, okay.
And I don't see a lot of growth there. So kind of where I'm thinking is looking at some of these publishers that are growing, like Pinnacle, Savage Worlds.
I haven't really dived into Savage Worlds yet.
Mm-hmm.
I've looked at Cortex a little bit. I've built some stuff for Cypher, and I want to like Cypher, especially since I like Sean K. Reynolds as a person, and he really helped me with ideas and stuff. And he's literally the reason I made Beastkin Vampires, because he mentioned that he wanted some more animalistic vampires in the world, and I made it. And he's like, "Oh, this is cool!" And he actually bought a copy of the D&D version and said the only thing that would make it better is if it were for Cypher. So I made a version for Cypher, and he was so nice because he actually looked at the first type, which was the Wolf Soul Beastkin Vampire. I sent it to him. He did a full editing pass on it for free.
Wow.
And sent it back to me with, this is how we do it in-house. And I was able to come up with a much better product because of it. So I really, really want to like Cypher, but it just doesn't feel, I don't know what it is about it. It just doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
The mechanics are just to me. I build stuff for Fate. I build a lot of stuff for Mutants and Masterminds, and that's something that I'm probably going to do more of. because I have a whole lot of superheroes and supervillains in my head, and they may be of some value. I've had a little bit of sales on the one supervillain I put out so far. The big problem with Mutants and Masterminds is it's a comic book game, so you have to have art, and I'm not an artist.
Yeah, and that's the thing where like collaboration that could come in, and seeing if you could submit works to Mutants and Mastermind, see if this, like, hey, this is, you know, what would it, and it's just reaching out to these different publishers, what would it take for me to write for you,
right?
And other places like Chaosium is doing open license now, and their whole RuneQuest thing, when you're talking about the way you develop these pantheons, it sounds like RuneQuest pantheons to me, because they all have their rituals, and they have like books just on one, like just one pantheon. They have like a whole book just one. So like that kind of thing that might work with their basic role-playing system. We're huge Free League stands, and they have their own workshop for different titles. And that's growing. So there's a growth business. Like, we just started running Dragonbane, and in all the Dragonbane groups, like, people are publishing and doing Kickstarters already for, like, new cards and new monsters and things like that. And because there's just, it's, the game just came out, and there's just not enough stuff for it yet. And so yeah, that's where the value is
yeah. possibly on my list for things to look into for that purpose. I love Free League also. Like, One Ring Second Edition is Free League. I would love to write for that, but of course that's a licensed property, so I would have to work directly for them, like, to do one.
Yeah, Alien you can't do. You can't do One Ring, but Dragon Maid and some of the other stuff is good. And the nice thing is the communities are super welcoming, especially as like they want to grow into the English market. So when we post stuff, we get a lot of good feedback, and they're very, very welcoming. The Dragonbane Discord does a monthly contest on content creation, and you can they'll have like a theme, and you just like make stuff for the theme, and you know they do a contest for everyone. So there's that kind of stuff. I think is great, because there's a hunger for it, whereas with 5e. Everybody and their mother is making stuff for it, so
yeah, it became a glutted market very easily. And that's definitely true. I'm also looking. I've got Fantasy Age.
Oh, okay.
From Green Ronin Fantasy Age Second Edition, and I'm liking some of that, because for me it takes one of the big problems of D&D and gets rid of it, which is the D20.
People love the D20.
Mathematically, it's horrible. It's completely, it's a linear progression, which means it's completely swingy, right? No matter how good I am, I have a 5% chance of drastically failing. No matter how good I am. No matter how bad I am, I have a 5% chance of auto succeeding, at least on attacks, right? I don't know how many times I have heard, man, on paper, my character's a badass, but I can't accomplish anything. That's all down to the D20. That's all down to the D20 system. A system with a bell curve of some kind in its dice, a 3d6 or a 2d10 or whatever, comes up with a much more reasonable mathematical distribution and a much more likelihood of succeeding most of the time, right? Of at least at the good thing you're supposed to be good at, right? For instance, I'm a first level fighter, which means I'm in D&D. I'm at least trained, right? I'm using the standard array, which means my highest stat is a 15.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a total of a +3 to hit. So a peasant standing in front of me, unarmed, unarmored, not good at dodging. I need a 7 or better to hit him. What?
Yeah, some of the dice pool systems that we've used have some pretty cool, they'll give you like a chart that basically says, so Savage is like that, kind of the Savage system too. As you roll different combinations of dice, there's a very, they'll show you these really good percentages, right? So if you're untrained and you're rolling the D6, you've got, you know, don't know, 15, you've never done it before, you know, you write, but it shows, it rewards expertise and investment in skills, yes, and stuff like that. And it's not, and I think linear. That's when... there is an excellent sort of curve.
See, that to me is the big problem with the D20 is it doesn't do that. The math in D&D 5e doesn't get forgiving in that way until the higher levels. And for some damn reason, people are convinced the higher levels are broken. And from my perspective, the math works out the best from 16th to 20th level. But like, GURPS has always had a table in there that shows you what the percentage chance of succeeding is at each effective skill level. So you have a really good idea what the math looks like and why it works that way. And okay, so I've got a 12 in a skill. That means I'm actually competent. I'm likely to succeed at this.
Yeah.
Unless I'm opposed, yeah, right?
Yeah.
Just the idea that the person who's good at something is going to fail as often as you fail and look so stupid doing it. Sure. I guess if you're playing a silly game, that's great. The swingy rolls I've found the D20 works for Mutants and Masterminds because it's a superhero game and you got super low lows and super high highs and any given Sunday, et cetera, right? And you're not making rolls for whether you can do this basic thing. You're making rolls to see if you can punch God. So it's fine for that to be swingy.
Yeah.
But yeah, I much prefer like a 3d6 bell curve. And Fantasy Age also uses a 3d6 bell curve. It's just 3d6 plus roll over rather than 3d6 roll under, which is what GURPS does.
I'm close to wrapping up. Matt, do you have any other burning questions? Because I've got just a kind of a wrap up.
I think I've covered looking at my little list of questions here. No, I'm good. Yeah. And also, yeah, for me too, I got to get down and help with this tile. Very tile project that we've got going on. So to assist with, we're putting in a backsplash, all very mundane. So not exciting.
Super fun.
All right. Yeah. So let me.
Okay. Great. Talking about the content, if somebody would want to check out one piece of content that you have on Drive-Thru, what is like the one piece that you're probably most proud of that kind of give them a feel for what you do?
Absolutely the most proud of. So the first one I put out was Gods of Rega, and I am proud of it, don't get me wrong, but I need art and I need to go through and do a revision on the layout and all these things I've learned since I started, right?
Right, right.
In terms of sheer visual appeal and how well put together it is, if you like 5e at all, give my FOMO Folio a shot.
Okay. All right. So I will put all the links to your Start Playing Games, your Patreon, your Drive-Through, especially that that last piece you mentioned, your website, whatever else you want me to do. I'll throw it in the description. Do you have any final parting words for our viewers and listeners?
Yes. Running games should be fun. If it's not fun, don't do it, even if you're doing it for a living. 2, don't stress out. Either you're running for your friends, in which case they ought to be tolerant, or you're running professionally, in which case stressing out is going to destroy you, so don't. Finally, you can keep it as simple as you want or as complicated as you want, but world building is never wasted. Everything you make for the world, it exists. It's out there. And here's the other thing about that. Every piece of content you make for your world is world building, even if it's just a dungeon. Because you have to think about how it goes with everything else in your world, why it's there, et cetera, et cetera. Well, you don't have to. Sure, plenty of people don't. I recommend you think about how it interacts.
Yeah. Beautiful. Thanks so much, Jack. It's good to finally have you on. I know we've been trying to do this for a while, and you know, life does its thing all of us, whether we want it to or not. Thanks for joining us, and thanks everybody for watching. I hope you got something out of this. It's been another episode of Between Two GMs, and Jack's right there in the middle. Jack Sandwich. Thanks, Jack. Thanks,
Matt. Thank you very much for having me on. It's been fun talking to you guys.
Thank you. Yeah. Nathan, thanks for making it weird right at the end. Right. You just gotta, I can't get through one show without making it weird.
That's my whole job. Yes. That's my whole personality, is making it weird. Anyway.
Well, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. All right.